Hey everybody, Ben here. Before we get started on this new episode, I want to first apologize for how long it took for me to put this out. In between me starting this episode and you listening to it, I made the very selfish decision to start grad school. As it turns out, grad school is a lot of work and I'm bad at multitasking. Anyway, I'm still figuring out how to make time for this show. I've thought about maybe taking the next few months to get as many episodes in the can as possible and then releasing them in batches. That way, I'll be able to take my time with each one rather than worrying about releasing episodes every couple of weeks. That being said, if enough people tell me that that's a terrible idea, I will absolutely reconsider. Let me know, and in the meantime, thank you so much for your patience and also for all the love I've gotten from people while I've been MIA. Please continue to spread the word about this podcast because I don't plan on going anywhere. Okay, on with the hate. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Skip Button, a podcast all about the music you love to hate. I'm your host, Ben Barzilai. Recently, there were two pieces of entertainment that really caught my attention. One was Woodstock 99, a documentary on HBO Max about the 1999 Woodstock Festival, which was noted for its outburst of debauchery, violence, and literal shit. The second was this year's Lollapalooza, the music festival in Chicago that was able to go on with the show in spite of the pandemic. Both of these featured a central figure, Limp Bizkit. If you don't know, Limp Bizkit is a new metal band that, starting in the late 90s, took over MTV and rock radio with their in-your-face juvenile delinquency. They took the most offensive and exciting parts of metal and hip-hop to create a sound that was an absolute phenomenon during the turn of the century. In the process, they racked up a healthy dose of hate from people both inside and outside the nu metal community. Hate from people saying they're offensive, lazy, and talentless. Up until recently, most people had relegated them as a weird fad of the late 90s and early 2000s. This, in spite of the fact that the band has been nominated for 3 Grammy Awards and sold 40 million records worldwide. Now that Woodstock and Lollapalooza have re-sparked an interest in them, I thought it was worth taking a deep dive to see if any of the hate they get actually holds up. Limp Bizkit was formed in Jacksonville, Florida in the mid-90s. In order to understand this band, we need to discuss how weird their lineup is. The band is led by vocalist Fred Durst. Durst has no musical training and can't play any instruments, but he was inspired by all the music that was beginning to take shape while he was a kid, from punk pop to heavy metal to hip-hop, and wanted to make something that mashed them all together. He teamed up with Wes Borland, a Florida-based guitarist with extensive training in country and jazz. Once they filled out their sound with a bassist and drummer, they then recruited DJ Lethal, a Latvian-American turntablist and hip-hop producer, best known at the time for his work with House of Pain. None of these people really seemed like they were from the same camp, and yet these misfits kind of came together to form Limp Bizkit, a name that Durst, forever a child at heart, came up with because he thought it was funny. According to Durst, quote, "The name is there to turn people's heads away. A lot of people pick up the disc and go, oh, Limp Bizkit, they must suck. Those are the people that we don't even want listening to our music." Other names that Durst considered included Split Dick Slit, Bitch Piglet, and Blood Fart. The band began making a name for themselves in underground music scenes, drawing particular attention for their cover of George Michael's Faith. Once the recorded version of this cover became a breakout hit, Limp Bizkit had established themselves as an exciting new name in nu metal. Okay, wait, so let's back up for a second. In order to discuss all the hate that Limp Bizkit gets, it's important that we talk about that term, nu metal.
The simplest way to look at it is an intersection of rap and rock. But if you're going to dig a little bit deeper, it's more, I think, like a cultural response to grunge and, you know, an era of rock that took itself a little bit more seriously.
That's Magdalene Taylor.
I'm Magdalene Taylor. I'm a staff writer at Mel Magazine.
Mel Magazine has this great article about nu metal written by Zarin Burnett. I'll link to that article in the description. It features a roundtable discussion with musicians and writers, including Magdalene, about the merits of nu metal. And I asked him to come on the show and he said, I'd be down, but the person you really want to get is Magdalene Taylor. He's referred to you as the resident expert of nu metal. Which is that a title that you hold near and dear to your heart?
Absolutely. I'm honored that he would say that because I do often feel like I cling to my nu metal identity pretty strongly, and it feels good when it's recognized.
In general, the genre of nu metal, with its perversions of rock and hip-hop sounds, is a genre that is often misaligned and misunderstood. But even fans of nu metal can sometimes give Limp Bizkit a hard time. So Magdalene was really helpful in giving me a better idea of how important this genre was and how it fits into the Limp Bizkit story. After all, we're talking about a genre that gave birth to some incredibly important bands like System of a Down, Linkin Park, and Korn. So was Korn like the first legitimate nu metal band as far as you're concerned? Like,
yeah, I label them in my mind as kind of the godfathers of nu metal as we know it. For example, the bassist Fieldy is like one of the biggest figures in establishing nu metal as a sound, because he kind of originated like the drop D tuning that gives metal that like chugging sound.
So drop D tuning is when you take the lowest string of a bass, usually in E, and drop it down a whole step to D. By pushing the lower register of the bass, you often get a much heavier, muddier, almost more percussive sound. You can hear that on songs like Korn's Y'all Wanna Single.
Y'all wanna single, say fuck that. Fuck that, fuck that. Y'all wanna single, say fuck that. Fuck that, fuck that. Y'all wanna single, say fuck that. Fuck that, fuck that. Y'all wanna single, say fuck that. Boom, 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 boom.
So I've already talked about the history of rap-rock fusion in my episode on Lil Wayne's Rebirth. As I pointed out on that episode, whenever someone tries to bring these two genres together, there have always been naysayers. But what I left out in that episode was that for a brief moment in the mid-90s, nu metal bands like Rage Against the Machine and Limp Bizkit were dominating cultural conversations by showing that it could be done. They took all of these genres, metal, hip-hop, punk, pushed each of them to their extremes, and then combined them.
Part of why I have so much respect for nu metal is, I mean, first of all, I see it as a much more innovative genre than people give it credit for. But more than that, I think that if you listen carefully to a lot of mainstream rock today and the mainstream rock that has come out since nu metal and up until now, you can hear the influences of it.
And if you listen to mainstream rap.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's,
I mean, we have like this current like emo rap moment that we have going on, I think, without nu metal.
But few bands were as extreme as Limp Bizkit. As evidenced by their name being literally Limp Bizkit, they seemed to thrive on macabre, offensive immaturity, the kind that sometimes took aim at women and gay people. Take, for example, their 1999 hit Nookie, a song about how far someone would go for some sex. My heart'll ache either way. Hey, what the hell what you want me to say? I won't lie that I can't deny. The fact that songs like Nookie were so lyrically infantile, plus the fact that the music wasn't all that innovative, meant that Limp Bizkit was an easy target for people who hated the genre. Limp Bizkit is not, I wouldn't call them the face of nu metal, but I think they're the face of nu metal for people who hated nu metal.
Absolutely.
I think that people looked at Limp Bizkit as like, see, this is why this genre is trash.
Yeah.
But you don't seem to be one of those people.
No, I love Limp Bizkit, and I think I understand why people view them as the enemy of the genre. Even people who love nu metal will make an exception for Limp Bizkit. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably is because Limp Bizkit, particularly Fred Durst, does embody the most macho, masculine, white, shithead mentality that maybe exists in nu metal overall, but Fred Durst really embodied it, at least aesthetically.
This is often what the hate against Limp Bizkit comes down to. They were dirtbags, and they didn't really take any pains to hide it.
Sometimes it surprises you when you like have a preconceived notion of a band. Can't say Limp Bizkit gave me any surprises.
Yeah, that's Miranda.
My name is Miranda Reiner. I am a music writer, question mark. I also host a podcast. I host a podcast called Endless Scroll with three lovely co-hosts. That's about it. I run a newsletter, which is fun. And I make zines. I run a zine press too. Wow. What do I do?
That's
so many
a lot.
Things. Too many things.
Miranda is an excellent writer and a great Twitter follow. You guys should definitely subscribe to her newsletter and her podcast, Endless Scroll, both of which I will link to in the description. Miranda recently took to her newsletter to talk about this recent reappraisal of Limp Bizkit, and she wrote it from the perspective of someone who never really engaged with them growing up. It was a reappraisal she found confusing and unnecessary.
Like, I guess the whole point of the piece is just like, does like Limp Bizkit matter? And it's about constant reappraisal in music journalism of things that you're like, oh no, actually this is good and this is cool, which I think is a super tired process. I don't know. It's just not a process that I get a lot out of like, oh yeah, this was like critically hated, but actually it's good.
Oops.
Maybe there's some value in that. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I don't know. But but like to do it with like something that was incredibly popular, like like Limp Bizkit was fucking so popular.
Huge.
Like they're not like huge. Like
I don't think I really realized until I started doing research,
so
like just
big.
How big they
they're
were.
Huge. They were like MTV was like Limp Bizkit channel.
Yeah, that's important context. We're not talking about a band that was chugging along in underground venues for their entire career. That song Nookie was off of their second studio album, Significant Other, an album that peaked number one on the US Billboard and has sold at least 16 million copies worldwide. Their next album, Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water, went platinum in its first week. It had the fourth highest debut sales of 2000, behind Eminem's The Marshall Mathers LP, Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again, and of course, NSYNC's No Strings Attached. Somehow, these dirtbags wormed their way into our hearts.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, Limp Bizkit, I'm all about Limp Bizkit.
Are you actually, though?
No, I'm not actually all about Limp Bizkit.
That's me talking to Justin Rubenstein, a comedian based in Boston.
Hey, buddy.
How's it going?
Oh, he's also my little cousin. Justin has been one of the people urging me to do a Limp Bizkit episode, so I wanted to talk to him about why he, as someone who's born the same year Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water came out, is so fascinated by this band.
You know, I think they get too much hate, Ben. Too much hate for the. And I just think they're funny. I mean, their name's Limp Bizkit. I just don't. And it's spelled B-I-Z-K-I-T. I mean,
it sure is.
Who's out there saying that's not the coolest thing in the world?
You know? So how much of you liking Limp Bizkit is just because like it's fun to say, oh, have you heard Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water by Limp?
Right.
Like, yeah. How much is it just you're like, I get a kick out of saying these words out loud to people?
Like a little bit, I feel like 50%, but also
that's
also,
more than a little bit.
Ben, I was listening to some early Limp Bizkit, and besides, you know, Fred Durst, you know, it kind of slaps.
This is something that I hear and read a lot about Limp Bizkit. Besides Fred Durst, they're pretty good.
His lyrics are just terrible, just awful. Very, very like, you know. I didn't get to have sex with this girl. Everyone should feel bad for me.
Yeah, this also comes up a lot when people talk about why they hate Limp Bizkit. There's a violent, sexist, borderline incel tone to a lot of their lyrics. This is how one writer from NME characterized it. Quote, I hate my daddy. Where? I'm drowning. Do you know how it feels to be face down in a rotting corpse, drowning in blood, so ashamed of who I am? I hate you. I fucking hate you, bitch. I'll suck. You should have kept my pants on. Mommy was a fucking bitch. I'm dying. I'm crying. You don't know what it's like. Where? End quote.
I think that's bullshit. I mean, sure. Korn in particular talked a lot about trauma, but it's like at the same time, don't we kind of want men to talk about their trauma? Don't we kind of want them to talk about their emotions?
Totally.
You know, it's like, what's wrong with that musically?
It's a fair point that Magdalene brings up, but I don't think it's a point many people would have been sympathetic towards in 1999. For people who already hated nu metal for its loud, debaucherous sound, these kinds of lyrics just added fuel to the fire. But Fred Durst didn't just exhibit shitheadedness with his lyrics. He was constantly pissing people off, including musicians, sometimes taking time out of his live performances to randomly insult people like Alanis Morissette and the Backstreet Boys.
But I don't think you should mellow out. Mellowing out? That's what Alanis Morissette just had you motherfuckers do. Birkenstock rock, y'all. This is 1999, motherfucker. Take your Birkenstocks and stick them up your fucking ass.
He'd even go after his own peers. During one live performance, Durst criticized Creed singer Scott Stapp, calling him an egomaniac. Creed's representatives later presented Durst with an autographed anger management manual. The one exception to Durst's tendency to lash out against artists is rappers. Throughout his entire career, Fred Durst maintained a steady respect for MCs, and for some unknown reason, MCs seem to like him. They have a number of astonishing rap features, like End Together Now, a track off Significant Other featuring Method Man.
Shut the fuck up. I'm plugging in them social skills to keep my total bills over a million. The last time I checked it, thank God I'm blessed with the mind that'll wreck it. Waited till the second round and knock him out.
They call me Big John Studd, my middle name Mud. Dirty water flow, too much for you thug. That can't stand the flood.
I really annoyingly like the song. Like, it really bothers me because I think the only reason I like it is because I have some dumb affinity for this style of rap music Fred Durst is playing with, not because he's particularly good at it.
You hear Method Man rap and then it goes back to Fred Durst and you're like, oh man, you really are like a not good rapper, huh?
Yeah.
Now so that I've heard bad. Method Man, really, like, you bad. Really suck.
Yeah, I feel like, and the problem is Fred Durst, he probably thinks he's like, you know, awesome.
Well, the thing that I do respect about Fred Durst is that he clearly, like,
very handsome.
He's so hot. No, the thing that I like about Fred Durst is that, like, he seems to genuinely love hip-hop. Like, he takes it, like, really seriously, and like Snoop Dogg is in his video for Break Stuff. And, like, nice. He, like, has worked with all these rappers. Like, even though he's not good at it, it definitely comes from, like, he definitely has a legitimate respect for it.
I worry that what Fred Durst saw in hip-hop was an excuse to be offensive and shocking. This was a pretty popular but erroneous sentiment about hip-hop at the time. But in retrospect, the band's use of shock value seems appropriative and contrived. But this was only 1999. MTV had only just begun to define popular culture, and the depths to which people could be shocked was still yet to be fully explored.
We already talked a little bit about MTV, and I feel like MTV made music very attention hungry. And I think that Limp Bizkit, one of the reasons they became so successful is that they knew how to do shock value in a way that just barely cross the line so that MTV would be like, this is going to get eyeballs, but we're also not going to get, like, in trouble.
Yeah, we're not going to get FCC'd, but...
Right. It is very, like, bluntly attention-seeking. It is loud and in your face, both in terms of the music and in terms of the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And then once they have your attention, there's really nothing past that.
Yeah,
like once they get you, they don't really do anything to keep you around.
People will argue that one of their guitarists is, like, incredible.
Yeah, Wes Borland. That's
Wes Borland, right?
Okay, so when I say that Limp Bizkit was little more than shock value, the little more mostly comes into play when we talk about Wes Borland, their guitarist. If you look into what's been said about Limp Bizkit throughout the course of their career, people find Fred Durst to be the most insufferable, untalented person to ever call themselves a rock star. Meanwhile, they think Wes Borland is the most gifted musical guitarist in the nu metal genre. Get up, fight! Head for the barricade!
Like, maybe that's true, but like, how is it possible for me to look past what is going on with Fred Durst? Like, to me, it's just like something so in your face that like it detracts from anything really good that is or could be going on behind it.
It brings up this question of, when is a band better or worse than the sum of their parts? Like, can you plop a great musician into a shitty band and make it better? Or just doing that just make them even more ridiculous?
I've heard people argue like, oh, he's so much more talented than like Limp Bizkit. Like, his other work is like so good. And it's like, great. Like, nobody gives a fuck about his other work.
Facts.
Like, no offense to Wes Borland. Nobody gives a shit. Tons of people give a shit about Limp Bizkit though. And like, why try to like make this like rift between like Wes Borland and the rest of Limp Bizkit? It's like, no, like, let's look at Limp Bizkit as like the accomplishment, you know?
Even fans of Wes Borland hated Limp Bizkit. It was a constant source of frustration for nu metal fans. Why was he wasting his time on this terrible band? This must have gotten to Borland because in May 2002, he left the group. When asked why, producer Ross Robinson stated, he doesn't sell out for money anymore.
In May 2002, this actually is a really fucked up. In May 2002, Durst posted Wes Borland's personal email address online and told fans to ask him to rejoin the group. Borland later stated that 75% or more of all the emails he got were people pleading for him not to come back to the band.
That's so funny. Wes Borland's costume's really cool, I think.
Yeah, so before we move on from Wes Borland, we have to talk about Limp Bizkit's presentation. If you watch any of their live performances, what you'll see is Fred Durst dressed in a plain t-shirt, baggy pants, and usually a backwards red cap. Then look to the right and you'll see Wes Borland, done up in elaborate face and body paint, looking like an alien monkey, a punk rock demon, or seemingly whatever was on his mind at that particular performance. Visually, the two of them together on stage made no sense. But then this was a band that was actively trying not to make sense.
Limp Bizkit, it reminds me of like you're in high school, and like your friends are like in a band, but they don't know a lot of musicians. So like they're just in a band with all the musicians that they know.
Right.
And they're all from like very different social circles. So all of the like weird little promo pictures they have look really bizarre because they're all dressed like they're in different bands. That's like what Limp Bizkit was, or
to be fair,
continues
is. I think that's literally what Limp Bizkit is. I think it was like, hey, you're from Fort Lauderdale and play an instrument. Like, want to be in Limp Bizkit? I'm pretty sure that's the backstory.
Want to be in my band, Limp Bizkit with a Z.
So speaking of live performances, let's talk about Woodstock '99. Limp Bizkit, as is probably no surprise to you by now, was known for their rowdy, riotous mosh pits. In 1999, they were invited to bring that energy to Woodstock.
Now you motherfuckers got a reason to jump.
Other acts that year included Korn, Insane Clown Posse, DMX, Metallica, and Megadeth. As is documented in the new HBO movie Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage, the festival was absolute carnage. Piss-poor planning meant that food was scarce, plumbing was unaccounted for, causing sewage to spill out into the festival, and eventually violence broke out, leading to sexual assault, injuries, and even one death. The blame for this calamity almost unanimously fell on the music, a notion that is at best incredibly short-sighted. Many people feel that while the documentary shed some light on all the things that led to this carnage, the blame was still put on the musical culture at large and not on the people who didn't think their guests deserved food or working bathrooms.
Yeah, that's a part of what I took issue with the Woodstock 99 documentary. To me, my biggest point of contention with it was that it tried to say that the reason why Woodstock 99 was violent was because of this like white male anger that nu metal cultivated and then, you know, pushed the audience to release themselves during the show, when in reality people were rioting because there was not enough water, not enough bathrooms, the place was filthy. It was really all about like the material conditions of the festival. That's why people rioted. It's not because Limp Bizkit performed Break Stuff.
It's just one of those days where you don't want to wake up. Everything is fucked, everybody sucks. You don't really know why, but you want to justify ripping someone's head off. No human contact, and if you interact, your life is on contract. Your best bet is to stay away, motherfucker. It's just one of those days. It's all about the he said, she said bullshit.
And this is why I think the question of hating Limp Bizkit is kind of an interesting one. It seems like they were at the center of this war that was being waged against violent art. This was a time where people were scared that video games were warping the minds of our children and that reality TV was producing terrible role models. And in the middle of all this, one of the biggest acts in the world was doing little more than venting their rage and telling people to stick their middle fingers up. They might not have deserved a heap of praise, but they certainly didn't deserve to be a lightning rod. As the Woodstock documentary kind of proves, hating on them for expressing violent rage distracts people from the causes of this rage, like people who think that delinquents don't deserve clean water. Even Miranda, who for most of my conversation was anti-Limp Bizkit, found this to be something worth re-examining.
But I also think like that's sort of why I think it's ridiculous to spend a lot of time moralizing or intellectualizing Limp Bizkit, be it in like the Woodstock documentary way where it's like kind of blaming Limp Bizkit, or at least shows people blaming Limp Bizkit for this chaos that happened that's not their fault. And
yeah,
or you know, using them to portray something about like late 90s teen white male anger. Like, I don't think that's fair or like their fault, because I think Limp Bizkit is just sort of a silly band that capitalized on what MTV was willing to give them, which was the whole world.
It is 100% worth it to look back at Woodstock 99 and nu metal at large and try to figure out what we got right and wrong. But obviously I would say that. That's kind of like my whole thing. But as Miranda suggested, maybe a full reappraisal of Limp Bizkit isn't entirely necessary.
I don't know. Limp Bizkit's just like fine, I guess. It's super dated in the lyrics. But it's like people love to like intellectualize like the shitty stuff that they liked when they were kids. You can catch me doing that about Owl City any day of the week. But so anyone can quote me on that. But
I
mean,
I have an entire podcast episode dedicated to JC Chazé from NSYNC. So
see, it's we all have our things. And for some, that thing is Limp Bizkit, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know that we need to like be dedicating a bunch of brain power to Limp Bizkit. I think the silliness of it is like why it's a little bit weird to like try to push that like narrative onto them.
I think that's why, after all my research into their music, my favorite Limp Bizkit recording is still their cover of George Michael's Faith. More than any other song in their catalog, that song really doesn't ask you to consider it as anything other than what it is.
Well, did you listen to their cover of Faith?
No, I didn't listen to their cover of Faith. Should I have? Is this a wreck?
Well, the thing about it is, so that was their, that was like sort of a breakout moment for them because it was off their first album.
Oh yeah, I didn't listen to that one.
And so it's a cover of George Michael's Faith. And that was sort of like the closest that I got to like getting it because it was a cover.
Because the lyrics weren't insane.
Yeah, well, partly that. The lyrics were written by like a good lyricist.
Right.
And the other part was that like, because it was a cover,
yeah,
it didn't really ask to be, it's a nu metal cover of George Michael's Faith. Like, it doesn't really ask you to like think too much of it. And then once you get past that, you can just sort of relish in the silliness. Whereas when you listen to their like actual like self-made hits, you have to sort of start thinking about the implications of like what this means for music and what this means for angry white men all over the country. Once you like just listen to the cover, you're like, this is fun and I kind of like this.
But of course, Miranda and I are only two people. There are plenty of thoughtful music lovers like Magdalene who still see a lot of value in what Limp Bizkit did.
In the article that we were talking about that Zarin wrote, you said in that article, Limp Bizkit epitomizes the worst kind of nu metal for a lot of people, but I really like it for what it is. For me, they represent the more fun, fuck you, stupid type of nu metal rock rap. The people who like nu metal but hate Limp Bizkit, what do you think that those people are missing?
Well, I think for a lot of people, they want nu metal to be like a more legitimate music genre in the eyes of, you know, the music critic or whatever. And there's a lot of strong examples for why that should be the case. I think like with Korn, you can dislike a lot of aspects about Korn, but still maybe acknowledge that there's some depth there and like some technical talent and things of that nature. But when you take a look at Limp Bizkit and the fact that it is like brazenly stupid, it delegitimizes the rest of nu metal in some people's minds.
Right. But I mean, I think especially, I think in retrospect, it's much easier to appreciate the stupidity because it is incredibly fun. And at the time when you're a part of this movement, I get how you sort of like want to hold it dear and be like, can you please make room for these other bands? But in retrospect, like, it, what nu metal song goes off harder than Break Stuff? like yeah, that's the exactly. fucking anthem.
Right. And I mean, it's like, I think a band that has an album called Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water is not asking us to, you know, present them with the Pulitzer. Like, we know, we like, they know and we know that there's something dumb here. But in my eyes, dumb and stupid cultural products are important still, and they can still have influence and nuance. And to me, I mean, that's so clear with the fact that like Limp Bizkit, despite so much of the hatred, was and still kind of is an incredibly popular band.
Limp Bizkit is still out here doing their thing. Just this past Halloween, they released a brand new album, Limp Bizkit Still Sucks, a name that proves that the band has always known exactly where they stood in the cultural conversation. There's nothing groundbreaking here, but it's a pretty fun album, and there are some riffs and rhythms that I actually found pretty cool.
Change hurts me in a loving kind of way. I'ma celebrate. Yeah. It's time to rock this motherfucker, cause I'm always out of style. Never change my style, cause my style is kind of fresh. You bitches asking for a sound check. Check 1, 2, bitch.
Then there was their recent Lollapalooza performance. Durst sounded as young as ever, but came dressed as an old man, poking some fun at just how long Limp Bizkit has been around.
I didn't actually listen to the Lollapalooza set. I love the wig.
we all love the wig.
Yeah, like, I, sure, Fred Durst, like, has been a piece of shit. But I think he looks great. I support the wig. I support him being a normal, functioning human being.
Amen.
That. And it led to me asking a question that I feel like it's been a while since I've asked on this show.
Would you ever see them live, or does that idea terrify you?
That idea terrifies me only because of the other people who would be there seeing them live.
Absolutely. I had tickets to see Korn and System of a Down before the pandemic happened.
Mm.
But yeah, 100%. I would spend my own money to go see Limp Bizkit. No.
Are you like a proper mosher? Like, do you get in there?
I mean, I would like to say yes, but I'm also like 5 feet tall, and like I get beat up, you know. Mm. So I can't really hold my own very well in there. But yeah,
do you think that's like another source of like people's sort of skepticism about nu metal is that like those places just get so wild and it's, you know, painted as sort of like a dangerous place for people, especially women sometimes to be in. Like, does that all at all register for you at all? Or do you think that people are just like misinterpreting what a mosh pit is?
I think they're probably just misinterpreting what a mosh pit is. I mean, it's like, sure, that happens like at a nu metal concert, but like that happens to for me, like literally every concert. Like I feel like I'm maybe going to get crushed. Like it doesn't matter.
If it was in Philly, yes. I was approached to go see Limp Bizkit play in New Jersey, in which I said no.
Is it because you can't get over the idea of I'm traveling to do this?
I would have to travel an hour and a half to Asbury Park, New Jersey. If you're going to like commit to the bit, like there are other bands that like I will commit to the bit and like, but, like if it was in the city of Philadelphia, would I go? If I wasn't busy, yeah, why not?
Right. It's I've been trying to find an organic way to say risk it for the biscuit. And I think I'm just going to leave it out. I'm just going to like plain say it. You wouldn't go to New Jersey to risk it for the biscuit. I'm so disappointed in myself.
I think it's good. I think that works.
All right. We'll edit it. We'll edit that in to make it sound really funny.
Thank you so, so much for listening to this episode of The Skip Button. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, rate, review, and let your friends know. Special thanks to Magdalene Taylor, Miranda Reinert, and Justin Rubenstein. Follow Magdalene at Magda J. Taylor and go read more of her stuff at Mel Magazine. Follow Miranda at Miranda Reinert and subscribe to her podcast, Endless Scroll. And check out her newsletter where she talks about plenty of other things besides Limp Bizkit. That website is MirandaReinert.com. Go find Justin Rubenstein's comedy on his YouTube channel, which is just Justin Rubenstein. Highly recommend. As always, follow this show on Instagram at Skip Button Podcast and check out other episodes and more at www.theskipbutton.com. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm trying to find ways to keep this going because I love the Skip Button and I'm hoping you guys do too. But in order for me to proceed, I want to hear from you guys. How long should these episodes be? How frequently should they come out? And more important, who do you guys want me to cover next? Let me know and I will see you next time, whenever that is, on the Skip Button. Thank you guys.